this whole time that I was doing the Gone Club and the Bad Seeds and Berlin, there was also a lot of other things always going on. Like I said, Hansa Studios was a hotbed of activity. I'm in West Berlin at the time. And one of the things that came about was the Die Haut records. And Die Haut were a band that had Thomas Wiedler, who was the drummer in the Bad Seeds, and Rainer Link and Christoph Dreher and Jochen Arbeit. And they were mostly known as an instrumental band with guest vocalists. Nick had done an album with them, Burning the Ice, and Lydia Lunch. So they were planning a new recording in Hansa Studio, and they were going to do this album, The Headless Body and Topless Bar. And they got, in the tradition of Die Haut, what they did was they made tracks, instrumental tracks, and then they got guest singers to do things on it. And so they were really, because of Thomas and Christoph was really involved in making a lot of videos with Nick and just people, you know, they were just in our little family of people. And they asked me to do a track or two on their record. So it was like really kind of flattering to them. I think I might have even suggested it to them that I do a track, because what I kind of saw a lot of was that they were getting singers to be on their record, and I thought that I would be a really good vocalist because of my kind of talking kind of style, and I thought what they needed was someone to like go through the music actually rather than talk over the music. And so I think they bought that bunch of baloney and let me do a track or two. So that was good. So that was like another step in the direction of my singing. It was actually a thing that I saw that I could actually fit in, and they got very excited about what I did with their music, which was more of an understated thing rather than singing. And then I did some live shows with them too, I remember, and that was really good because it was really fun to just go on stage without a guitar and go on for 4 minutes and do a song and leave. And then they did another album a year or two later, which was actually celebrating their, I can't remember if it was 10 or 20 year anniversary. And so this record, they got out the big guns. They already had Nick Cave and me or Mick, you know, they already had, like, you know, their friends on it. But then they decided for the head-on album, like, they got Ellen Vega and Debbie Harry and actually Jeffrey Lee Pierce to do numbers on it. And that turned out really fun. And I ended up doing a duet with Lydia Lunch, which was fun to reconnect with her and finally do a project, you know, 100 years later. The thing that was fun about that is that they actually put a tour together, not a long one, but a short one, and it was a very kind of crazy, debauched circus of people. So for the live tour, it was me, Anita Lane, Lydia Lunch, Blixa Bargel, Nick Cave, and Jeffrey Lee Pierce, and Alex Hacka. We did some good ones, and they were really smart and advertised it as their big, you know, 10-year anniversary, and we did some crazy shows and really had fun. Got a big tour bus and all jumped in and had crazy disco parties on the freeway and danced in the aisles and then went on stage, and that was really a pretty fun experience. I had written my own lyrics for all of those songs, actually. It was good because I was actually doing a lot of writing again. The community of people I was with were really good, literary, smart people, and we always traded books, and there was a lot of reading going on. We were very interested in our lyrical writing and prose and things, and that time was really influential and made me feel confident as a writer of lyrics. So because of the Die Haut experience, I was a lot more confident in singing. This was about like post Mother Juno too, and I was once again gonna try to do a solo record, and I asked Robin Guthrie again, who I'd met through Mother Juno, and some friends of mine like Marcia Schofield from The Fall, and Barry Adamson, and this guy who produced the record, Ray Conroy. He was the manager of a band called Color Box, and that band Mars that did that Pump Up the Volume song. We had an idea that we were going to mix kind of our rock and dance music together, and with my kind of guitar playing on it. And that was going to be the form for my solo album, record, or whatever. It turned out to be EP. So we recorded that in London at September Sound, which was Robin's studio. And that came out to great critical fanfare. But something crazy happened with Rough Trade, where the warehouse that was holding their stuff weren't getting paid, so all this press, and I made a video, but the record didn't come out till 4 months after the press and everything because of the holdup of the records in the warehouse. So more indie torture. And nothing really came of that besides a record recording. You know, I never did a live set for it or anything. I don't know what the reason why that was the last kind of solo thing. I think because right after that, I got involved with making Congo Nouvelle, which actually became a project I got really into. And we had a singer who could more than enough sing. Sally Nouvelle, an incredible singer. And I got so excited about her singing. I really wanted to write songs that would be really good vehicles for her to sing. I thought that there was her voice could be completely devastating if people wrote the right songs for her. I wanted to really dedicate time to working with her, and it was such good chemistry that there was no reason to kind of do anything else. So that was part of the reason why I didn't do any other solo stuff. Congo Nouvelle was a band I started after I moved back to Los Angeles, probably 89, 90. And we were introduced by a mutual friend. He told me about her, and he had mentioned she had been in a Wim Wenders film as well, and that there was this like amazing singer he knew, and she was really dying to do something but didn't really have quite a direction, and or people, she couldn't find the right people to collaborate with. And she was actually in the film business in Los Angeles, so it really didn't give her a lot of time to pursue her musical thing. But what she was doing was singing standards at a jazz club one night a week or one night a month or something. He invited me to go with him to go see her, and I was completely devastated by this incredible voice she had. And she had a really great voice, really great stage presence, and she really sang these standards, but somehow made them her own and made them like really come to life. And I wasn't just singing standards, it was like they were coming from her. And so I was really, really impressed, and immediately was like, oh, I have to do something with her if, you know, if she's game to do something. I met her and we embarked on doing something. And what we first, the first thing we did, because we really didn't have a band or any kind of thing, was that we decided, you know, we were talking about a lot about our friends and AIDS, because that was a time, another kind of, like I've talked about, the second wave of a lot of the second generation of people dying of AIDS that were our age and were our peers and our friends, you know, is because we know a lot of artists, we know a lot of drug people who took drugs, we know a lot of sexually promiscuous people, a lot of gay people, and and it was like everyone, it wasn't like one group of people, like this, the first wave of our friends was like all gay men, and it was like even getting closer to our age group. And so we were, you know, obviously very distraught about this, but very much wanted to make something good come out of it. And we decided that we would write a song and or two, like that would reflect kind of the emotional part of it, and the because of her being a jazz singer, it was kind of like, well, let's focus on you know, making like a torch song addressing this, and like the subject being a little more, how can this, you know, you see some light, kind of gospel-y. So we wrote some songs. We wrote that song Lullaby. It was the first song. It's like we made that EP. I had this John Lee Hooker bootleg where all he's doing is tapping on his guitar the whole time and it's making it ring. And so I was playing around with that. So we did made a song like that, which is became our big hit. Always a big one in our live show. We got some people to play with us. Jim Sclavunos played with us for a while. And, you know, we got some people together and actually made a band. We started to play live shows, kind of like art events and like AIDS benefits and things like that. And kind of slowly it morphed into a band and we started making songs. And then we realized that we wanted to continue and actually make a band out of this and be serious about it. So we gathered our friends together, Christian Hoffman and this woman, Mary Mullen, and we started to play live and started to get a following, and our EP had a little culty success and was well-liked. Somehow we got really lumped into this trend of lounge that was emerging in the world, especially in the Los Angeles world. Yeah, we attracted the attention of some people who put out records. Put out a record on this label called Basura. It was funny enough, distributed by Priority Records, who were like Ice Cube and NWA's label. So it was like a really funny thing that they wanted to start an alternative label. So we put out one album, Music to Remember Him By, that was the title of it, and did a lot of touring. Priority wanted us to do another record, and they wanted us to be on the big Priority label. So we made another album, and that was really well done. We put a lot of work into it, and it came out really great. It got to the point where they already had promos mailed out, and it was starting to get reviewed. We had tour books. And it was getting really rave reviews, and you know, we were really getting notice, and it just seemed like, wow, something's going to really happen, because you can tell when it's going to happen by the pre-press. The last second, the Priority, without a word, just decided they weren't going to put out their alternative records anymore, and they were not going to put this record out. So we were like left kind of high and dry and really devastated, and we begged them to let us buy it from them. We did everything, and they just would not budge. They were really, their lawyers were in lawyer head, and it kind of didn't matter what we said or how we pleaded to them on whatever artistic level they were, or whatever business level we had tried. They decided they're just going to sit on it. We were really upset and devastated and mad and angry and ready to murder somebody. So we decided, well, they're really not going to give it to us, and this is really fucked up, and we are going to move to New York, because LA is obviously not the place for us, and this whole game is really a stupid game, and we don't have any part of it anymore. You know, we're like worth so much more than that, and why don't we go where someone might understand us and want to do something? We packed up a Ryder truck and drove across the country to New York and moved here. That's where we are now. And I've been here ever since. And so that was a whole, you know, new thing for us. I felt really great finally moving back to New York. I knew a lot of people. The music scene at the time was really great. There was like a real support between bands and a real camaraderie and a real kind of music scene going on. That's very different from how it is now. It wasn't just young new people. It was like a lot of people who'd been around. It was very artistically driven and, you know, very, very up for grabs. And we got a record label right away and recorded an album that was Abnormals Anonymous. And that had a big, good success. Somehow we weren't able to tour, and this kind of had to do with just kind of some personal restrictions. You know, Sally had to work, and Sally had a kid. She wasn't able to leave as easily as in the past. She had gone through a divorce. She didn't have a husband. You know, she was being a single mother. So we really only played locally some, you know, East Coast. And so that kind of led to a little bit of disillusionment and putting things on hold for a while. And we just said, well, obviously we can't do this right now, like kind of physically do it. So let's see what happens. And we haven't got back together just yet. But there's often talk about it. We've done many reunion shows and many collaborations together, but we haven't gone the whole hog. I think, and that's only because I went on to do other bands that were kind of demanding of my time.